This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening, I'm David Gale and welcome to The Informer. Tonight I'm joined by Paul McClure. HIV advocates and health organisations are outraged the Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee, PBAC, has rejected submissions to add Truvada as use for PrEP to the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. Tonight we talk with Mark Stuve about this decision and the path ahead. Later we talk with Jackie Brown, disability and LGBTI rights activist, writer, spoken word performer, public speaker, workshop facilitator and disability sexualities educator. There's a lot in there anyway. Jax will be on the show, and later we'll be checking with Shannon Power with a wrap-up from the Star Observer. Public health advocacy groups say they are dismayed a drug that can reduce the spread of HIV will not gain a federal subsidy as preventative measure. Earlier this year, the Therapeutic Goods Administration approved the use of the antiretroviral drug Truvada, as a pre-exposure prophylactic, which is PrEP, to reduce the spread of sexually transmitted HIV. The pill taken once a day had become popular with thousands of gay men in Australia who wanted to reduce their risk of contracting HIV. The drug is up to 95% effective in preventing HIV infection, according to the HIV Foundation. It's already listed on the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme as a treatment for people who have contracted HIV, but the Independent Pharmaceutical Benefits Advisory Committee last Friday recommended Truvada not be added to the PBS as a preventive drug, citing concerns it would not be cost-effective. Tonight on The Informer, we are joined by Mark Stuve from the Burnet Institute. Good evening, Mark.
Good evening, David. Thanks for inviting me on.
Great to hear your voice, and it's great to have you on The Informer. Tell us, what does this decision mean?
Look, essentially it means that there will be some delay in public subsidies being available for PrEP. It doesn't stop people accessing PrEP through, you know, online sources, or if you're a part of some of the demonstration projects that are going on in Sydney and Melbourne and will soon commence in Brisbane. But in terms of accessing PrEP through a PBS subsidy, there will be some delay in that occurring, and ultimately the delay will depend on the process from here. The PBAC has essentially asked Gilead to start again with their submission, and there will be a subsequent submission.
And resubmit, of course.
From Gilead.
Yeah. Look, what would happen to the rates of infection if Truvada was widely available?
Look, undoubtedly, it would have a significant prevention impact. How much? We're not too sure. When we designed the PrEP-X study, which is an extension of VicPrEP that the Alfred Hospital, the Burnet, Victorian AIDS Council, and other partners have implemented, we worked out that if we could get around 2,000 gay men in Melbourne onto PrEP in the next, 6 months or so, that we anticipated it would potentially prevent 70 new cases of HIV arising, in the following 12-month period. So, you know, that is modelling. We don't know how it would actually play out in the real world. And, you know, partly that's why we, implemented, PrEP-X, the expansion study, partly to cover this gap in public subsidies for PrEP, but also to examine it, from a research perspective, its population impact on prevention. But undoubtedly it would, prevent a meaningful number of infections in Australia.
So who's funding that sort of those PrEP-X trials? Who funds those? Is it the state funding those?
Yeah, so at the moment it's the state jurisdictions that are funding these expansion trials.
Right.
And it's essentially, they've come to the party on the basis that the international evidence is extremely strong for this drug. unfortunately, in Australia, we do have, there are issues in relation to, the regulatory environment here and the ability of the regulatory environment to respond timely sort of way to these types of innovations. So it takes time for, process through the TGA approval and then through the PBS for, drugs to be, widely available that, we know are very effective. So, really the hat's off to the Victorian and the New South Wales government for putting a substantial amount of money into the expansion of PrEP into the at-risk community, knowing that, that there is a very effective prevention tool that we have here that that there is not equitable access to, and that also that we know people are importing from overseas and potentially, not being appropriately clinically monitored when they're doing so. So the jurisdictional governments have sort of stepped into the fold, but, really also anticipating that ultimately the Commonwealth government would come to the party and the drug would ultimately be listed on the PBS for public subsidy.
Yeah, it's sort of like a paradox, though, that, Queensland has a trial going at the moment, also New South Wales and Victoria. Is that a case of the federal government just passing the buck or not spending their health dollars on these sorts of trials and leaving it up to state jurisdictions to do the research work before they even consider anything about it? Is that what's happening, or is this just general practice?
I don't think it's certainly not a political decision-making process. It's purely a regulatory process that companies need to jump through.
Sure.
Look, the PBS ultimately just make these decisions on what to put. Precious taxpayer dollars into the health system. They make these decisions on two decision-making bases really. Firstly, is what is being proposed effective or more effective than current standard care? In this case, there is no current standard care for this. So they work on the basis that it's effective. And look, the TGA basically through approving the drug has really said yes, it is highly effective for the purpose of prevention. The second point is it cost effective?
Yeah.
And ultimately where we're stuck at the moment.
I was going to cover that. The quoted cost at the moment is $105,000 to $200,000 a year to treat someone at high risk of HIV infection. I mean, $105,000 a year, and, you do simple maths, so that price is one tablet, a daily tablet, $287. That's ridiculous. Is that Gilead's modelling of those sorts of figures? Is that just incorrect, or what's happening?
Look, this is not unusual. In some ways, a lot of these, a lot of this process can be, it's similar to, an enterprise bargaining agreement where you've got, the two sides and they start at, either ends of the spectrum and ultimately then they know, there's a wink and a nod and everyone knows that they're ultimately going to meet in the middle somewhere. So, look, Gilead have put up, a proposal as to, how much they're going to charge for the drug. And the PBS, did their calculations and looked at the Gilead modelling and decided that this is not, a cost-effective proposal. So, they've really put the onus back on Gilead to come back with a price that the PBS would determine. They have very distinct thresholds as to what is cost-effective, and it's not just related to, prevention. It's related to sort of every drug in terms of, the quality of life improvements or the extra, the years of life lost that are prevented here. So, there's a certain formula that they go by, and Gilead need to go back, back to the office and do their homework and work out where they think the price point is for Truvada and come back with a new proposal.
I mean, it sounds like a sad state of affairs where, you know, you put in an AMBIT claim of something really high like that, and we're talking about 1,200 people that will contract HIV this year, because every year there's about 1,200 Australians that contract HIV, which, you know, PrEP's going to reduce that number, hopefully. And, you know, that AMBIT claim just sort of supports the fact that people are importing the drug themselves because it's been priced out of the market. Look, if PBAC had approved Truvada, it would still need to be approved by the federal government cabinet. Now, that can take up to 12 months. Is that the sort of case that you think would happen with a drug like this? Or would they say, you know what, we want to get on with this?
Yeah, look, I would hope that there would be enough community pressure to get on with it. And, you know, really from the prevention benefit and the, you know, the lifetime health costs associated with caring for someone with HIV, you would hope that the federal government would come to the party relatively quickly if PBAC provided the recommendation to the health department that you know, they recommend the public subsidy of PrEP.
Yeah, no, it still comes down to numbers, even though we're talking about people's lives and their quality of life as well. The Australian annual rate of new HIV infections hasn't dropped for a number of years, and PBAC is sort of wasting time by not approving the best opportunity available to eliminate new infections. But we can understand that they're saying, this is an AMBIT claim, get your act together, Gilead, and see what happens. Look, thank you, Mark Stouve, for talking to us tonight. We look forward to talking to you again at Joy 94.9. Mark Stouve from the Burnet Institute, great to have you on The Informer.
Sorry, no problem at all. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Melbourne Writers' Festival is Melbourne's annual two-week celebration for writers, readers and thinkers. Each year in August, they present the talent and ideas of hundreds of writers from Australia and around the world through a vibrant program of storytelling, conversation, discussion, intellectual debate, educational programs, live performance, music and the arts. Jackie Brown has been named one of the top 25 LGBT people to watch. She's a disability and queer rights activist, writer, spoken word performer. She presents workshops on disability and sexuality for university departments, disability organisations and women's health organisations. Disability rights continue to be a driving force in Jax's life, as does a commitment to raising awareness of the issues affecting people with disability and how we can create change. Welcome, Jax.
Oh, thank you. Good evening.
Quite an intro, I know, but you do a lot. You do an awful lot.
I'm pretty busy. I do like six things at once most of the time.
It's fantastic. Look, before we talk about your involvement in this year's Writers' Festival, I'd just like to hear what you think, what your reaction is to yet another delay by the government on the proposed plebiscite.
Look, ultimately, I think we don't need a plebiscite. I think the vast majority of the Australian population is in favour of same-sex marriage. It's a big waste of money, and I'm really concerned about the kind of queerphobia, homophobia, biphobia, transphobia that's going to come out in the media when the Christian right and conservatives do a campaign to be anti-same-sex marriage. So I'm really concerned what that means, particularly for young people and queer people with very little supports in their life in terms of, how they're going to navigate that space of having all that kind of hate in the media directed at us. So yeah. I think, the time is past for stalling by the government. The time is now for actually creating equality in the country and making same-sex marriage a reality.
I had to ask that one because I've got one of the top 25 LGBT people to watch on the line at the moment. At this year's festival, you're going to be at a session called Feminism Online. What can you tell us about this session?
So that's going to be a session that's free, so people can come along. They don't have to pay. They can just rock up on the night. And we're going to be talking about being a feminist writer online. Why do we do it? What do we get out of it? What are some of the challenges of being out feminist online in terms of some of the misogyny you can encounter? But also on the flip side, like the sense of community that you can get as well by finding a feminist community, which is something that I've found as a writer and as a feminist, that there are a lot of great other thinkers and writers that you connect with because you're writing on this similar social change kind of stuff.
Yeah. Look, is it because it's easier to be a feminist online versus offline?
No, I think it's harder to be a feminist online in some ways, in terms of, like, people can be really horrible online and horrible in a really discriminatory kind of way that I don't think people are to the same level in real life. Like, people can hold really different opinions, and you can be at a dinner party or whatever having a discussion where you come at things from a really different perspective. But often I think when you get into these kind of debates, and they will occur at the bottom of articles that I write, people hold really, really intense, sometimes really bigoted views about LGBTI things, about disability things, and also about feminist stuff, and express them in a way that is really quite difficult to deal with. And there isn't often a lot of room for movement in those kind of discussions. So I think that in some ways it can be harder to have those online spaces when you're getting those counter views. And often people will write, you know, that the nasty things more than they'll write, oh, wow, that was an amazing piece of work. Like, so that's hard as well.
Do you think that's because when people are posting in an online environment, they have that effectively a smokescreen to hide behind? They don't have to look somebody in the eye and argue with them or say that they disagree with them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, like, there is an element of the population that kind of has fun with trolling and kind of taking that extreme position, and particularly with feminists, to kind of, to bait us and to be really horrible and to see kind of what they can say and where they can kind of push a conversation. So we're going to be looking at that a little bit, but predominantly we're going to be looking at the positive side of it. So what are the benefits of writing feminist stuff? Why do we need to produce feminist work online? What does that mean for feminists of all ages?
Maybe empowerment, perhaps.
Yeah, in terms of finding our communities and finding our voices and finding each other. I know for myself, with regard to LGBTI stuff and disability community as well, that it was really, really fundamental for me, living in a rural area as a young person, to actually have those online spaces where I could find my community. When my community wasn't actually present around me, I could really find a sense of myself and who I was in a virtual space.
Look, Jax, if writing about your personal life is or isn't a feminist act, is there a part of yourself that you have to hold back or hang on to that's just your own? Like, you know, if it is a feminist act and you're putting it all out there, is there anything that you have to hold back yourself as a writer?
Look, not really. And this is something that I perpetually grapple with because of the different marginalities that I hold. In terms of, like, what is personal, what can I keep to myself, and what do I put out there, and how do I kind of frame that? So I guess for me it's framing it in a political way. It's showing how that personal stuff really is political and how it relates to a broader kind of social picture and a need for change. But, yeah, I am pretty kind of, in a lot of my work, in my performance work as well as my writing work, I do talk a lot about really personal kind of stuff, because I see that as being really interesting and fun for me, but hopefully amusing and kind of interesting for an audience as well, to give them a bit of a different perspective on things.
Jax, you just going back to your previous comment about the online community, how do you find that the online community fosters that development of relationship with women, particularly from a feminist perspective?
I think that there's some amazing work out there, that there's an array of different perspectives and different opinions that you can find as a feminist, and different intersections that you can kind of, you know, you can read feminist disability works, which I read a lot of, you can read queer feminist work. So you can really kind of find work and create work that really speaks to the particular intersections that you're experiencing in your own life in a way that really wasn't available for people, you know, before the advent of the internet. You could still kind of maybe seek it out and find it in a library somewhere if you're lucky, or be part of a consciousness raising group or whatever, but you didn't have this ongoing access. And one of the things that I found really helpful is that, you know, like my virtual life and my virtual communities are just as important as the actual ones in my actual life in terms of creating spaces where I can explore and express what it means to live these different identities.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would, in some ways, growing up as an LGBT person in the mm-hmm. days before the internet and before the online environment, it was incredibly difficult. I mean, now you've got literally the whole world in front of you. If you type in a search category, you can find as much information as you need. So that certainly widens your choices and gives you all that information at your fingertips, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think particularly like groups online that you can join, that you can feel connected to and part of, is really, really important in terms of if you feel isolated in your geographic space or your social network at any one point, you can then, you know, feel connected and log on and become part of something in the virtual world where you get a sense of belonging.
Also, I've used the internet thing with my grandfather's glasses on, and I was reading The Desirable Lesbian Chris, which is a piece by you. It's only a short piece, and it talks about disability and sex. I mean, you say these two words together and people tend to get uncomfortable. Many people assume that I possess no sexuality and that people with disabilities can't be powerful, desirable, or know their bodies and what they want. A fantastic article, and if anybody has a chance, you must check out The Desirable Lesbian Chris. I might actually put a link onto our podcast to it, if you don't mind, Jax. You know, this is the other thing that you bring to the table as well, being a disabled GLBT activist. And it's quite a triple to put together as a writer.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of my work, my performance work, and also my more serious kind of written political work focuses on the intersections of the disability sexuality experience as it intersects with queer identity. So, yeah, I do a lot of stuff around what does that mean, how can we make it accessible and engaging for people that maybe haven't thought about these issues, how can we make it humorous and political and powerful and something that I kind of want to explore as well. So I do a lot of, a lot of performance work as well as written stuff around queer erotica.
Okay, well, the session is called Feminism Online. It's at part of the Melbourne Writers Festival. It'll be on at the ACMI, The Cube. It's free, so the price is right. This Sunday, the 28th of August at 5:30, we'll put a link on our podcast so that people can see when the event is on. And it's certainly worth popping along. There'll be books available for purchase from the Readings Festival Bookshop before the event, which means authors can sign them as well if you want a signed copy. But if you want to meet Jax, just get along. I think it'll be a fantastic discussion with Giselle. And also there's a moderator, Christy Clark, as well. So make yourself available to get down there this Sunday night. And thanks, Jackie, for talking with us on The Informer.
Thank you very much.
And tonight, of course, we're joined once again by Shannon Power, Shapow, from the Star Observer. How are you, Shannon?
I'm very well. How are you tonight?
Oh, look, I'm excited because I've been looking through the September issue, which is just out of the Star Observer, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. Bear community, you promised it, and I've got to tell you, I love it.
Well, we've had a really good reaction to it. So we thought the cover was a bit risque, but every now and again it's fun to do something a little bit risque and show a bit of skin. So we're really happy with it this month.
I'm checking out the page 12 boy covered in honey, and there is something to growl about, which is the name of the article. An amazing article about something to growl about is about self-image, body image, bears mm-hmm. not actually understanding that there are other people out there about it. It's sort of about a young guy who didn't know that, you know, there were other people like him. I mean, it's a great article.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think particularly in the gay community, there's so many different subsections and different groups and different, you know, stereotypes. And I think the main stereotype is a buff, super stylish, camp guy. But, mm-hmm. of course, that doesn't apply to everyone. So even though some people are really well aware of their community and other community, we thought, well, why not let's do it again, just to highlight the fact that because depression and suicide are really huge issues in the LGBTI community, and we shared one person's story to sort of highlight the fact that there are people with self-esteem issues, but there's also people like you out there.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's rife throughout a whole subculture, I suppose, if you call us as LGBTIQ people as a subculture. But in the end, you know, the article, well, it's all about, you know, coming together as a group rather than just sort of going, oh, you know, I'm not going to sleep with you. You've got too much hair on you and all that sort of stuff. I thought it was really, really good. There was another great article, which people have to get their hands on the issue, about Juliette Jacques, who is coming out to Australia here for the Melbourne Writers Festival, and it was, look, I really wanted to get an interview with her, so I'm jealous that the Star Observer once again has trumped us here at Joy.
Oh, well, you know, you've just got to, I guess, know the right people, and you know, Greaseau said, though, it's not how we do it at all. I think we just probably put in a PR request, and you know, they happen to answer our email, which isn't a sexy way to do it, but we try our best.
Yeah, I know. I'm jealous. Look, we've been talking tonight on The Informer about Truvada being denied access to the PBS scheme. We've been talking to Mark Stouvet from the Burnett Institute, which has been great. There's news on the website about that. Also about the plebiscite being pushed back. What are your feelings on that?
The plebiscite being pushed back,
yeah.
Or Truvada? I'm not sure that it comes as a huge surprise. I think once we knew that Parliament wasn't sitting until August 30 and it took so long to figure out how Parliament was actually going to look, I actually anticipated it would be later in the year. I think what is really important over the next few weeks is to ensure that this plebiscite doesn't happen, that it gets blocked in Parliament and at the Senate, so that it just doesn't go ahead at all. So I guess it being in February buys us a little bit more time, because it's just not something that the community should be facing. We have to do everything we absolutely can to make sure that it doesn't go ahead.
Yeah, we'll find out about...
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.